Okay, well, we are going to begin tonight where Joel Schulte left off 2 Wednesdays ago. And if you remember, Joel covered this really great section in the first part of Exodus 15. And this is the Song of Moses, where Moses and then also Sister Miriam break out spontaneously in this song, which summarizes all that the Lord has done for the children of Israel. It's a magnificent song or prayer put to song. And like a lot of the parts of the Old Testament, it recounts what the Lord has done. Many commentators describe the Exodus from Egypt and the plagues that were unleashed on Pharaoh, and then the crossing of the Red Sea is the greatest act of God's power in the Old Testament, and to be contrasted with the greatest act of power in the New Testament, which is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So it's a significant event and it's chronicled. But we can't help but notice the juxtaposition or the great contrast between the Song of Moses and then the next part of Exodus 15, which we'll be looking at. And I just wanted to go through a couple of slides here to kind of give us some context. There's this great picture of the really, really massive group of people that are passing from Egypt on their way to the Promised Land through this formidable wilderness, this really unsparing wilderness. Lord, was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a pathway for the redeemed to cross over? Isaiah asked this in Isaiah 51, again recounting this mighty act of power that the Lord displayed on behalf of his children. Here's a great map. It's hard to nail down some of the places where the children of Israel were. I mean, it's if you I've got a series of 8 maps. I had some discussions with Jeff Takacs, and we were talking about this, and it is difficult to nail down beyond the first couple of locations exactly where they were. And of course, as you know, there's great debate about what exactly or how the wilderness journey occurred, whether it was the land bridge at the bottom of the Gulf of Aqaba or another path. But the bottom line is, we are up at the top here to the upper left-hand corner. They have left this lush portion of Egypt, and they're beginning their wilderness journey. And we are going to have several locations tonight that we're going to take a look at. Here's another map here. This is the territory of the Ishmaelites and the Amalekites. And we're beginning again right around the Egypt here, and we can see where the black arrow is, the wilderness of Shur, which will be the first wilderness area we're going to be taking a look at. Some great maps out there and such, but mainly that's my focus here, to kind of point out through this black arrow where the children of Israel are at this point. This is the wilderness of Shur, just a really extremely barren and dry place. There was a I remember listening to a sermon by Charles Swindoll addressing Dallas Theological, the students there, where he was chancellor for many years. And he talked about how he went to Israel for the first time with a friend of his who had been there many times, and they were driving to the Negev, the south of Israel, the southern desert-like area. And he said to his friend, "You know, certainly we can see that the vegetation is getting less and less green, and we must be in the wilderness." And his friend kept saying to him, "Not yet." And so they drive a little bit more, and there's less vegetation. And he would say, "Surely this must be the place." And his friend would say, "Not yet." And they would keep rolling and rolling until they came to places that were just completely barren. And this is where the children of Israel are traveling through. I just wanted to read a couple of notes that I used previously. The first part of this note here is to note that the narrative that Moses has written continues from the book of Genesis. You could almost remove the two different book titles. This is a continuing narrative that we're looking at. It's as though, in this first bullet, second bullet point, it's as though it is thought of as a continuation of a narrative. It picks up the storyline that began in Genesis and was completed in 3 more books, making up the first division of the Hebrew canon known as the Torah, the first 5 books. Torah meaning law, instruction, or teaching. Also, since the second century AD, it was also known as the Pentateuch, or the first five books, penta meaning five. And just a couple more points. In the beginning of Exodus, we see that the first this first example of a practice that appeared in almost all of the historical books in the Old Testament, the use of the simple conjunction here to begin a book. This feature appears to indicate that the writer was conscious of the fact that he was contributing to an ongoing sequence of revelation and narration. This is a series of books that are written to the children of Israel to remind them where they came. In the Pentateuch as a whole, there are six major themes. You can see theme three, four, five, and six here. The focus on God's deliverance in the Exodus from Egypt, God's revelation of himself in covenant, law, and tabernacling presence at Sinai, the wandering in the wilderness, and the preparation for entrance into Canaan, even though effectively it's going to take 40 years to do that. So again, that focus is chronicling the history of the Israelites. And finally, it's important to keep in mind that Moses is writing at the end of his life to the Exodus Jews, the exiting Jews, the children of Israel. Why? To remind them of where they came from and that it is God who has separated a people to himself, the Israelites, the apple of his eye. I'm going to stop sharing screen and we're just going to focus now on just looking at Exodus 15. Let's turn there. And we're going to pick up here at verse 22. And this is called the wilderness program. Essentially, from Exodus 15, verse 22 through the end of chapter 18, the writer Moses is chronicling the testings of the Israelites. And what we effectively have is we have Israelites that have been under the slavery of Egypt. It first started out very good for them, then it turned into just a situation where they were completely controlled by Egypt. They were working as slaves, uncompensated. And as they're delivered out of the nation of Israel and Egypt, their character has not progressed very much. You could essentially call them new believers. They're traveling with a group of people. Some of them are hangers-on, some are it's a mixed multitude. The book of Numbers calls it that. And the Lord begins to test their character because they're not spiritually mature enough to enter into the land of Canaan. And so we have this story of the waters of Marah, which is captured in verses 22 through 27 in Exodus 15. Let's read the first couple of verses here. It says, "So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea." This is Exodus 15, verse 22. "Then they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water." Verse 23. Now when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah, literally bitter. And so this wilderness program or this itinerary began back in Exodus 12, verse 37, and is mentioned again in Exodus 13, 20, 14, 2, and now again in 15, 22. And I just want to read a couple of verses. So this is Exodus 13, verse 20, and it says, "So they took their journey from Succoth and camped at Etham at the edge of the wilderness." Etham is another name for the wilderness of Sin, which is short for Sinai. Exodus 14, verse 2 says, "Speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon, and you shall camp before it by the sea." And then our portion tonight, Exodus 15, verse 22. "So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, then they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and there they spent 3 days in the wilderness and found no water." As can be seen, the narrative begins just abruptly. We go from the Song of Moses now to this situation, and it's just so remarkably different from this celebratory Song of Moses to complaint, basically. And thus starts the narrative here. Here, let's just make a comparison. Exodus 15, verse 2, within the Song of Moses says, "The Lord is my strength and song, and he's become my salvation. Here is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him." And you can compare it with Exodus 15, verse 24. "And the people complained against Moses, saying, 'What shall we drink?' One of the most persistent features of this whole section is the grumbling theme, or more specifically, murmuring. And what is amazing is that outside of Joshua chapter 9, verse 18, which references the children of Israel's displeasure with Joshua, who cuts that deal with the Gibeonites, who by fraud lie to him about who they are. And also Psalm 59, verse 15, which describes how they were wandering up and down and howling for food and they were not satisfied. Every other occurrence of grumbling in the Old Testament is found in six chapters of the Pentateuch: Exodus 15, 16, 17, Numbers 14, 16, and 17, and then, of course, this passage as we go into detail tonight. As we heard from Jeff Takacs, there is general agreement on the locality of these first stops made by Israel. We know the desert of Shur, verse 22, is the whole district ranging from Egypt's northeastern frontier eastward and to the northwestern quarter of the Sinai Desert and extending southward to the mountains of Sinai. Shur means a wall, basically. And this is the place mentioned several times in Genesis 16, verse 7. Let's quote a couple of verses from Genesis here. Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. And this is speaking about Sarah's handmaiden and her son Ishmael. And you remember that Abram is nagged by his wife. He grabs her by the hand and the child and pushes her out with just a wineskin filled with water, and she's kind of on her own. This is a forbidding place, the wilderness of Shur. Here's Genesis 20, verse 1. And Abraham journeyed from there to the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and stayed in Gerar. And then there's another quote st stating sort of the same thing. Here's Numbers 33, verse 8. This area is also called the Desert of Etham. And I'm throwing out a lot of verses, but we're just kind of getting some context as we begin in this narrative of complaint, essentially. We can notice that at first the Israelites contended with a stony desert, which was bounded by the deep blue waters of the Gulf of Suez on the right and the mountain chains of El Hurat at some distance from the shore on the left. After about 9 more miles, they came into the desert plain, which is a white, glaring stretch of sand that turned into hilly country with sand dunes rolling out to the coast. But there simply was no water to be found. Marah itself is usually identified with a site several miles inland from the Gulf. And the point here is that the waters are notoriously salty and consist of river and seawater kind of mixed together. Edward Robinson, a biblical commentator and biblical researcher, said this: "The basin is 6 or 8 feet in diameter, and the water is about 2 feet deep. Its taste is unpleasant, saltish, and somewhat bitter. The Arabs consider it the worst water in all of these regions." And so the children of Israel are led there, and they begin complaining in verse 24, "What shall we drink?" As a general pattern, the grumblings that went before the golden calf incident, that's Exodus 33, are raised by genuine need. Those that follow are kind of illegitimate forms of murmuring. Numbers, the book of Numbers picks up a lot of that stuff. And so one of the key points is that this bitter, undrinkable water at Marah made a strong enough impression on the Israelites that it effectively just erased all of the memories of the miracles of Egypt. Here they are 3 days into the wilderness wandering, and it's as if none of that ever happened, and they begin to pine for the days in Egypt. So it kind of erased all of the memories of the miracles of Egypt and the parting of the Red Sea, and so we have it. And of course, you know, this can happen in our own Christian life, right? Where we encounter situations that are a test to us, and we sort of like forget, well, I'm not including you, and if I can forget about the things that the Lord has said in the past, and we just have to kind of remind ourselves, you know, certainly that there are tests that the Lord puts in front of us to develop character. Verse 25, Moses cries out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, and when he cast it into the waters were made sweet. The Lord showed Moses a tree. The verb showed means, or to teach or to instruct, very much like the Torah. Torah is instruction and law. And so we see this the first beginning of the Lord's instruction to the children of Israel. And of course, that's what they were supposed to do. They were to keep these precepts in their mind and on their heart. They were to teach it to their children and such, and they were to live on every word that proceeded from the mouth of God, as opposed to just reacting to circumstances and such. The Lord is developing character here. The point of the one of the things that could be the purpose of the narrative is for Israel to learn that the instruction they needed after being freed from Egypt would come from heaven, every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. And this in turn would prepare them for the reception of the precepts, a lot of precepts of the laws, 600 or so, pretty much laws, 600 plus laws that regulated every aspect of their life, civil, religious, basic interactions, food, dietary laws, and such. And so the text is clear that God gives Moses special instructions in response to the despair of the people. One thing on the tree here, the emphasis here is that there was nothing in the tree necessarily. It was like the salt in Elijah's healing of the poisoned. Where Elijah throws salt into the cruse, that is the pot of poisonous gourds. It's not the salt or the tree necessarily, it's God's healing power. Of course, there have been many sermons that have been preached on the tree being the cross of Christ, or likened to the cross of Christ, which, when added to a bitter situation or sinfulness, takes the bitter sting of sin away. It lends itself to some great preaching, but in this particular case here, we're just going to move on. And that is the cure. God gives them the cure through this odd instruction, and it's the solution, and it's instruction come from heaven. In both cases, Elijah's throwing in the salt, the tree thrown into the bitter waters. In both cases, it may be that the power of God and a test of obedience are the point here, and they are the point here. God's power, the instruction given to Moses, the obedience of it, and this test here. There he made a statute and an ordinance for them, and there he tested them. The scripture says that in Exodus 15, verse 25. In verse 26, it says, and it said, if you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. So the miracle is connected with a promise, and specifically that from now on, obedience to commands and statutes would bring healing, both physically and morally. God allowed Israel to go 3 days without water to test them. Literally, the Hebrew verb means testing, and has the same root as the word masa, which we find in Exodus 17, verse 7. God later tests Israel at Meribah, at Sinai, at Taberah in Numbers 11, and elsewhere. This is the Lord's workings here. And it was to humble them and to test them in order to know what was in their hearts. Listen to Deuteronomy, as Moses is summing up things in Deuteronomy. He says this in chapter 8, verse 2. Every commandment, Deuteronomy 8, verse 2, every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. Verse 2, and you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. Just finishing up the chapter here. Talking about these diseases, the Lord's promise that he would not put the diseases of the Egyptians on them. A lot of historians note that the Egyptians tended to brag about their good health and their life-invigorating diet. Some of it goes into great detail, the eating of dried fish and living off of, fresh foods and those types of things. But their defiance of God made their diseases and plagues legendary. And an excellent example of that is the young boy King Tutankhamun. He's of the royal line, and when the tomb was discovered, and then later with medical technology being able to do scans and such, it turns out that he was not in great shape. He had notable deformities, a lot of physical issues, probably suffered from some chronic diseases and such. And you would think that this is the best, he enjoyed the best of Egyptian technologies and medical attention and such. And so the point is that the Egyptians were afflicted by things just simply because of their defiance to the Lord. Verse 27 says of Exodus 15, then they came to Elim, where there were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees, and so they camped there by the waters. Israel journeyed to Elim, located in this large and beautiful valley, about 7 miles south of Ein Hawara. And I'm not exactly sure where that location is. This tract of land lies between the wilderness of Shur and the wilderness of Sin, or short for Sinai, and contains two other wadis. And remember, Steve Sanchez did a great job many years ago of pointing out some of the physical features of the land. A lot of wadi is defined as a valley, a ravine, or a channel that is dry except in the rainy season. And so they're camped beside this particular wadi. And in the rainy season, there's this constant torrent of water running down the Red Sea that slows down in the dry season. And so this is pretty dry here. And the grass is thick and high. There are many tamarisk, acacias, and palm trees in this area where they camp. So the Lord is testing them. I know that I'm probably moving at somewhat of a quick pace here, but we're going to then cover chapter 16. So let's turn to Exodus 16 and look at the manna and the quail. This is, let's take a look at Exodus 16, verse 1. And it says, and they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. Verse 2, then the whole congregation of the children of Israel, here it is again, complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. Verse 3, and the children of Israel said to them, oh, that we had died by the eat, and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Imagine Moses with, I don't know, a million. Psychology is such that you get a couple agitators going, and all of a sudden the whole crowd is up in arms. And Moses, Aaron, and the elders of the children of Israel have to deal with this. We've got the Israel had left Egypt at this point, and there are a couple of places that are noted. Numbers 33 verses 5 through 11 notes 7 places of encampment, but only one journey of 3 days' duration. And it's evident that either Israel stayed at several of these places for a number of days, or they camped in a number of other unmentioned places or areas without specific names. One commentator notes that the Hebrew text seems to say that they set out from Elim, and implies that they may have left Elim in various detachments and finally assembled as a complete group when they reached the desert of Sin.
I just want to interrupt you.
Sure.
Just a little bit.
Can you what?
You cut out just a little bit a couple of times.
Is that right? Yeah, I've
But that's okay. What I'm gonna do is I'm just gonna, next time you cut out, I'm just gonna turn your video off. All right?
Okay,
So we'll just keep going.
can I I'm just gonna sneak closer to my router. I've had this happen a couple of times. I'm hoping this will help a little bit, but yeah, do what you have to do, Neil. No problem.
If it cuts out again, I'll just turn your video and we'll see if that helps.
Okay, perfect. So I wanted to keep in line with Jeff Takis and his teaching. But the problem is that the location of the desert of Sin here is kind of problematic. We don't quite know where it is, but wherever they are, this time the people grumbled, verse 2, about the amount of food and the lack of meat, verse 3. And so again, we have suddenly Egypt in their eyes seemed so good in comparison to the present situation. Actually, pots of meat and all you could eat. That's kind of what they said here, rather than bondage and slave drivers. I remember somebody quoting this a long time ago. Nostalgia can be defined as the sandpaper that smooths the rough edges off the good old days. And that seems to be what happened here, only it didn't take very long for their nostalgia to grow of Egypt. I mean, first it's 3 days, now it's 30 days into the journey here. And look at what they're saying here in their complaint. They use this kind of twisted piety and a condescending reference to Yahweh's name. The Israelites pretended that they would have preferred being victims at God's hand in Egypt to being the recipients of so many miracles and all this hardship. So it's pretty clear at this point that with the provision from Egypt, probably, I mean, they packed a lot of stuff, but it's pretty much winding down. They're starting to lose faith in the Lord, and this complaining is starting to kind of get out of control here. Verse 4, then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not." Verse 5, and it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. So God would graciously answer the Israelites' grumbling by raising down on them bread from heaven. What's interesting is I remember an old-time Bible teacher on TV talking about Psalm 78, verse 24, and he asked this question: what do the angels in heaven eat? And he answered by quoting Psalm 70, verse 24 in the King James, and it says, the corn of heaven. And a lot of times, the corn of heaven is likened to this manna that we're going to see, this delicious food from another realm that is given to the children of Israel, and it's sweet to the taste. Not sweet to the taste like the books of prophecy that some of the minor prophets had to swallow and Jeremiah. This is sweet to the taste all the time. Their prophecy, they would sweet to the taste, and then it turns bitter. In this case, they're able to dine on this sweet manna, and then later on a provision of the birds here. So there was to be a test to see whether Israel would obey and trust God by faith. Already prior to the giving of the Ten Commandments, the seventh day was to be set apart to the Lord because it had been established in Genesis chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. And so the Lord here on the sixth day said, he says to the people on the sixth day, the people were to gather twice the daily amount, verse 5, and it was not to be left or eaten in the form they had gathered it. Instead, it was to be prepared by milling and baking it. And this is a quote from Numbers 11, verse 18. Verse 6, then Moses and Aaron said to all the children of Israel, at evening you shall know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning, verse 7, you shall see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your complaints against the Lord. But what are we that you complain against us? Verse 8, also Moses said, this shall be seen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening, and in the morning bread to the full, for the Lord hears your complaints which you make against him. And what are we? Your complaints are not against us, but against the Lord. So the first part of verse 18 explains that Israel's kind of forgetfulness would be restored that evening, verses 6 and 7, when God sent them food in a way that he has not announced yet. Then they would know, here's this phrase again, as we saw this previously in the plagues, that it was the Lord. Here's proof that the Lord is at work. The second part of verse 8 gives explanation of the kind of inner meaning of the words. Your grumbling is not directed at your leaders, but ultimately your complaint is against God. And God is very gracious with them in these provisions here. Here's the Bible, I'm sorry, the Bible Expositor's commentary. It says this: therefore, we have the theology and abiding principles to be gained from Israel's appreciation and ours. For what God did here is placed in front of the actual narrative of the events, this theology and abiding principle. Verse 9, then Moses spoke to Aaron, say to all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your complaints. Verse 10, now it came to pass, as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 12, I've heard the complaints of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. So Moses is instructing Aaron to gather the congregation. They were to come near before the Lord. And note that after Sinai, this instruction would mean that Israel was to gather before the tabernacle. But of course, this is occurring before the tabernacle has been constructed, before the design is given to Moses. So consequently, verse 10 explains that they were to look toward the desert where the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the meaning of this symbol is of the real presence of God connected with the splendor of his cloud and fire, as they're going to see throughout their wilderness journey. Once again, Israel will know that I am the Lord your God, seen in verses 6 and 8. The Lord is impressing this point on them. Verse 13 says, so it was that quail came up at evening and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance as fine as frost on the ground. Verse 15, so when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. Verse 16, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it according to each one's need. One omer, roughly a quart, for each person, according to the number of persons. Let every man take for those who are in his tent. Verse 17, then the children of Israel did so and gathered, some more, some less. So when they measured it by omers or quarts, he who gathered much had nothing left over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. And of course, this is miraculous how the Lord plans this out. These events are describing the gift of quail is similar in form but separate in time from what we see in Numbers 11. That event takes place in the second year of the wanderings. But here, the quail, literally it just says feathered fowls here, are a well-known migratory bird in the area. They usually fly in vast numbers in the spring to the northern regions and return in the fall. And here's the point. Because of their long flight over the Red Sea, they land exhausted on the shores of the Sinai Peninsula. And so it's easy to grab them and gather them. Not only did the quail come up from the horizon, but so did the dew. The dew also came up. When the dew evaporated, beneath it appeared thin flakes like frost on the ground, on the desert floor. Here, this manna must be seen as this strange or peculiar substance miraculously created for a special purpose, but similar in respects to certain other known substances which are still produced in the Sinai region. This is one commentator mentioned. What is it literally is what manna means. Manna really means what is it. Each family unit was to gather an omer, about a quart to 2 quarts, or 1/10 of a bushel for each person in their tent. Here, it's very interesting that Paul uses this illustration for Christians in 2 Corinthians 8 to share with one another, just as Israel had pooled the manna that everyone had collected. Paul uses that principle or analogy for giving. He said, you know, when someone has a lot, they can give. When someone has little, they don't give. and it all sorts of work it all sorts of it all sort of works out for the church. When someone has a lot, they give. When someone has little, they don't. When someone that the one who has little has more, that person can give, and it benefits everybody. And so that's the illustration that Paul had used here from Exodus 16. Verse 19, and Moses said, let no one leave any of it till morning. Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses. This becomes a problem for the children of Israel throughout their wilderness journeys. Obviously, they didn't quite obey Moses all the time. Some of them left part of it until the morning, and it bred worms and began to stink. And Moses was angry with them. So they gathered it every morning, every man according to his need. And when the sun became hot, it melted. Boy, it would have been neat to see what this manna was like, but it's plentiful and it's exactly what they need. In spite of this warning that God was testing the people by ordering them not to leave any manna until morning, some paid no attention to Moses, verses 19 and 20. Were these people who paid no attention part of the mixed multitude or hangers-on or folks that went along that were not true Israelites? We don't know, but whatever it was, they caused a lot of trouble. Again, this was to test and to remind Israel that they did not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord, Deuteronomy 8, verse 3. In addition to that, it taught Israel that even their daily bread was a gift from God, and therefore they were to live in dependence on Him, especially in the wilderness, where there it was as barren could be. This is a whole long illustration and exercise in depending on the Lord. Little bit more here, verse 22. And so it was on the sixth day that they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. Then they said to them, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today and boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourself all that remains to be kept until morning. So they laid it up until morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. Then Moses said, eat that today, for tomorrow is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none. Verse 27, now it happened that some of the people went on out onto the seventh, or I'm sorry, went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you the 6 day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. Verse 30. So the people rested on the seventh day. Eventually, they got the point that the seventh day was a day of complete rest. It was a day of rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. And it was grounded in the ordinances of creation. So this pattern of 6 days for gathering and 1 day of rest had been ordered by God, verse 5, and the seventh day was to be a day of cessation or rest, verse 23. Therefore, food preparations for the next day were to be made on the sixth day. When some failed to obey, the Lord groaned, how long will you refuse to keep my commands and my instructions? And only then did the people stop, cease, or rest on the seventh day. Finally, now, last couple of verses, verse 31, and the house of Israel called its name manna, and it was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Here is a commentator or another commentary that says coriander seed is a small lobular grain that is white or yellowish gray and is used for seasoning. We could call it caraway or sesame seeds today. Numbers 11, verse 7 says that it looked like resin, and according to older versions, it had the color of delium. It tasted like wafers made of honey or something made with olive oil. verses Numbers 11, verse 8, and it could be ground in a mill, crushed in a mortar, cooked in a pot, or made into cakes. Again, Numbers 11. Finally, here, verse 32, then Moses said, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Fill an omer with it to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness. Then I brought, when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And Moses said to Aaron, take a pot and put an omer of manna in it and lay it up before the Lord to be kept for your generations. Verse 34, as the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony to be kept. And the children of Israel ate manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. Now an omer is 1/10 of an ephah. Excuse me. Just want to drink from my Packers mug here. At some subsequent time, Moses ordered that this giving of the manna be memorialized by placing some of it into the Ark of the Testimony. Notice that the Ark design hadn't been revealed yet. It hadn't been built at this time. This is what the Lord commands for the future. And Moses writes that the eating of the manna continued until the end of the wanderings here. If you read in the King James, as they began to enter into the promised land, they stopped eating the manna and they ate of the corn of the land. Again, that word appearing there. And so literally the Lord provides from them from the first step to the last step as they depended on him during their wilderness journey. And that thus concludes Exodus 16, and we'll conclude there. And I went a little bit longer than I wanted to, but we'll just end at that point.